There's certain things, certain times in a person's life which hugely motivate them. Alexander the Great seems to be motivated by two main things when he was young. And this, they're two quite interesting ones. One was history, and it was the history of the Persian oppression and the way Persia had actually at one point pushed into Greece. And him being Macedonian, he very much sort of envisioned as a young man, and as a boy even, turning that around, punishing them for what they'd done. The other thing, and this was a major motivation, because we see it in his conquest, was that he wasn't just a soldier. He was someone who constantly was establishing cities. And this was not just, in a sense, a big-headed way, because he liked the idea of having Alexander in Egypt, or the other one way out on the edge of the empire, which is called sort of Alexander the Furthermost. It was because he believed, he'd been told by his tutor, the Greek Aristotle, that Greeks were the one who had a right, because they brought culture and education, to rule the world. And so these were powerful motivating factors. And they actually, basically, drove most of what he did. I don't say all of it, because I think later we see a certain amount of megalomania. But they certainly drove a lot of what he was about. Now, when we get to Revelation 18, we're basically seeing, or being sort of, it's almost being sort of shoved in our face. What is our motivation? What is our motivation? Where are we in this? Because it's actually quite important, isn't it? We were looking last week at the sort of prelude to this, the sort of setup for this, where we're introduced to this prostitute, this gaudily, brightly, dressed lady who represents Babylon. And we were sort of seeing that, you know, although she seemed to have power, although she seemed to be in league with satanic influences, ultimately she came to a bad end. And really we're going to see that happening this week. So that, first of all, basically raises a question. Why is identifying with Babylon so bad? Well, the first thing we note is this, that it's a front almost, isn't it, for satanic activity. After John has been introduced to the character of Babylon, and in a sense we see it's not just Babylon the city, it's the oppressor of God's people, it's economic powers, it's all that reject God. It says another angel came from heaven. And this is rather interesting, isn't it? It says he had great authority and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice he shouted, and before we even hear it, we know this has got to be something pretty monumental. Fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt of every spirit, a haunt of every unclean and detestable bird. The first thing we see, isn't it, is a front for satanic activity. It's symbolic of godless societies and peoples. The theme here is a very Jewish one. It's unclean. And certain birds were unclean. When it says every detestable bird, the birds that tended to be unclean in Jewish thinking were those that scavenged, those that lived of death, dead animals. And that certainly made you unclean if you were a Jew. You didn't want to touch a bird that did that. That's the first thing, isn't it? What's the second thing? Well, it's this. Babylon, these economic powers, these authorities that reject God, have lured people, nations, away from true worship. This is why she's really portrayed as a prostitute, and we see that in verse 3. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries, and the kings of the earth have committed adultery with her. The merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. There's sometimes, as you know, this phrase that's used, a bit crude, isn't it, for business deal. They're in bed with. Well, here's the picture here. It's literally almost where it comes from. The kings of the earth were in bed with her, as it were, metaphorically speaking. What's the other thing? Why does it draw people away? Well, people look to her. Look to these systems for their security. Again, like Alexander the Great, in a sense, it's their motivation for living. Look at what sort of we see here. We see quite quickly the merchants of the earth grew rich on her luxuries. What else has it got to tell us? Well, we see, don't we? The merchants of the earth, verse 11, they weep because their source of income, their source of commerce has happened. It's gone. It's no longer there. It's no longer. Verse 15, they weep, don't they? They mourn the great city as they see it. Others mourn as well, don't they? You look at verse 19. You see the sea captains, everyone's sort of somehow connected, interconnected with her. She's got influence, she's got power, she's got trade. In a sense, that was their religion. That's what motivated them for getting out of bed in the morning, as it were. You know, there's a rather interesting sort of epilogue to Alexandra. These big dreams he had, these dreams that Greek wisdom would rule the known world, came to nothing in the end. Yes, he established a magnificent empire. I mean, it was extraordinary. If you'd sort of said, oh, by the way, the kingdom of Macedonia is going to take on the Persian Empire, everyone said you were mad. Persian Empire was the superpower of the day. Alexandra took on forces 3-4 times his size. He defeated them. He had a knack for military flair. If there was a way that seemed impossible for him to get through, he'd take an army through there. If there was a place which seemed impregnable, he'd find a way to conquer it. But in the end, he died at the age of 32, worn out by his campaigning. His empire was split up between three of his generals, and within a few years they were fighting each other for it, and it came to nothing. He had other plans. He'd gone east. He was planning originally to go back to Babylon, where he died, to start the conquest of the West. I can't help thinking that when Jesus sort of says, you know, what does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? And he would have known, the Jews would have known about Alexander the Great. He'd been through Israel. It was only 300 years ago. It's well-known history. I can't help thinking that it's Alexander that motivates that example. And you see, just as Alexander's dreams came to nothing, everything these people put their faith in has come to nothing. It's now gone. Their motivation's gone. Their religion's gone. So we see that Babylon is a front for Satan. We see that it's drawing people away. We see people look to it for their, in a sense, their salvation. And lastly, it persecutes God's people and demeans people. One of the interesting things, it's almost missable when you look at that list from 11 to verse 13, is what's their trade? Well, it's all this stuff, it's all this luxurious stuff, but it's the bodies and souls of men. And ultimately, there's a picture here, isn't there? that certain systems demean, you know, human dignity. Some people perhaps, you know, were thinking it'd be very common today, well, you know, say it was talking about slavery and stuff like that. I don't think it necessarily is. It's talking about Babylon, in a sense, doesn't it? Represents everything that's bad in culture. It represents everything where, you know, people are, you know, devalued by their work, There's not the respect anymore. Governments that don't respect the rights of the individual. Governments that oppress Christians or oppress anyone. And in the end, really, when we come down to it, we saw it last week. It's not surprising because she was drunk on the blood of the saints. We see in verse 24, in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints. And actually, and of all that had been killed on the earth. There's a sense, isn't there? We see the mark of Cain going right through the Bible. And here it is, typified, in a sense, crystallized in Babylon. So what should be our reaction to Babylon? Well, it is to reject it. It is to have nothing to do with it. It's interesting, isn't it? After this first angel has announced the fall of Babylon, we then get a second voice, probably a voice of an angel. We don't know. It could be from the throne. But John just hears another voice, and it's this: come out of her, my people, so you will not share in her sins. So you will not receive any of her plagues. For her sins have piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. One of the things we noted about Babylon last week is that, as we said, she was so linked with the beast from the sea. And the beast that this prostitute or mother of prostitutes rides on is very much similar to the beast of the sea. And we think of the link of that to Satan, the dragon, and the beast of the earth. And here we are, literally. Here we are, we've got someone, literally just a front for the demonic forces. It's rather interesting that the end we saw last week was there was no honour among thieves. And there's, in a sense, no honour between, you know, between Satan and his lackeys. In the end, you see, we have to be apart. And that's a challenge, isn't it? Because actually what we're seeing, I think, more and more, is a merging of the church with the world in this day and age. It's a worrying thing, isn't it? You know, I don't want to be too controversial tonight, but, you know, do hear me on this. There's good people in the Church of England, and I want to say that, and I have a huge respect for the heritage of the Church of England and the churches that are valiantly preaching the gospel there. But it seems to me a tragedy that Church of England schools are now sort of leading the way on the transgender agenda, as it were. It's not kidding you, just look around at what's happening. Very much at the forefront of it. Kids being encouraged if they want to come and dress some way differently. And that's happening in church schools. That's frightening, isn't it? But that's perhaps just a more obvious example of ecumenicalism. Multi-faith worship. Take a step back from that. What about those who are now denying the sacrificial nature of the penal, you know, substitution of Christ? You know, we have to ask this. The heart of the gospel is eroded. I'm going to say straight off, if I was asked to stand on a platform with one of those people, I will not. Because that is not the gospel. You know, sometimes I don't want to get into sort of one of these things where, oh, woe is us and, you know, everything's terrible. I find it quite ironic. I just found it so strange a while back. The two most downloaded sermons I preached on Galatians were the first two. What were the titles? No other, except no imitation, which is all about the gospel. And the second one was, when is it right to disagree with other Christians? You know, actually, there are people out there who are looking for answers. I just wonder whether, it could be a freak, I don't know. You don't know what goes on, do you, half the time? But, you know, there is a sense in with that. But, you know, the sense is there, isn't it? It's one of the things that grieves me the most. I really don't like it when I have to disagree with other. And, but sometimes it's disagreement with people I do recognise as Christians. But there's a line we can't cross. And sometimes, sadly, it's a case of where the Christian gospel has been lost altogether. So there is a real need, isn't there, to think and separate ourselves. We are to reject also the self-made culture. You know, Babylon had done pretty well for itself. Verse 7 may seem vengeful, but look at how she boasted. I sit as a queen. I am not a widow. I will never mourn. And Babylon never thought, when she was exploiting, or whether the system she represent were persecuting God's people, she never thought she was going to get her comeuppance. No, she boasted about it. The actual phrasing there is very much a take on Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 47, verse 8. Now then, listen, you wanton creature, lounging in your security, and saying to yourself, I am, and there is none besides me. I will never be a widow or suffer the loss of children. That's said in relation to the Babylon of Isaiah's day. That is very much predicting the fall of that enemy of God's people. And here we are, we have her again, representing, in a sense, the metaphorical Babylon, representing all that would oppress. And it boasts, our day will never come. Prosperity is here. We'll never get our comeuppance. That's another reason why we should reject that. We don't want to be part of a self-made culture. You know, the phrase self-made man is very popular, but if we actually take scripture seriously, there's no one who's a self-made man. If they get away with anything, it's because God allows them to for a time. If he doesn't judge them, it's because he's gracious and giving them a chance. Right, what else should we do? Well, we should rejoice at the judgment of God. We are called to, aren't we, in verse 20. Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you. Now, I think one of the things that we have to understand about this is we can sometimes look at this and say, well, isn't this vengeful? But I think we have to understand, firstly, the depth of the sin. The other thing we have to understand is that when people set themselves up against God's people, they are setting themselves up against God. The other thing is this. The saints and the prophets, the martyrs, are often reviled. Think of those who suffered under Bloody Mary. If you look at Fox's Book of Martyrs, things like that. They were reviled. They were called unbelievers. Their souls, as it was said by Catholics, were damned to hell. Justice says they ought to be vindicated by being faithful. They deserve that, don't they? The saints under, we saw earlier on, didn't we, that the saints under the altar really, in a sense, cry out, don't they, for vindication. That's back in chapter 6. But we should rejoice, shouldn't we? Because he's bringing his purposes to fulfillment. One of the rather interesting things before we got on to the seven plagues and the seven bowls of God's wrath was how it mirrored the Exodus. And the Exodus was a great theme for celebration, wasn't it? This wonderful bit, they sung the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. In a sense, they're one and the same, aren't they? Because the Exodus was all about God taking his people out of the oppression of Egypt. And we think about that wonderful song Miriam and Moses sing when that happens. God has brought them out. He's saved them from the superpower of the day. And the picture is here, isn't it? God has redeemed a people for himself. And if he's done that, then judgment must follow. It must be set right. And we see, don't we, that he's bringing everything to fulfillment. This picture in verse 21 where this mighty angel picks up a boulder the size of a large millstone and throws it into the sea, which really announces the fall of Babylon, the fall of this, as I say, metaphorical Babylon that represents all the enemies of God's people, all the systems that would oppress God's people. It's really just picking up, it's a harking back to Jeremiah. And the picture very much in Jeremiah is this. And it's 51, verses 59 to 64. This is the message Jeremiah gave to the staff officer Seraiah, son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, when he went to Babylon with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, in the fourth year of his reign. Jeremiah had written on a scroll about all the disasters that would come upon Babylon, all that had been recorded concerning Babylon. He said to Seraiah, "When you get to Babylon, see you read all these words aloud, then say, 'O Lord, you have said you will destroy this place, so neither man nor animal will live in it. It will be desolate forever.' When you have finished reading this scroll, tie a stone to it, throw it into the Euphrates, then say, 'So will Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster I will bring upon her, and her people will fall.'" And just as Jeremiah prophesied judgment against the enemies of God's people in that day, we get a sort of bigger, we get the fulfillment of it now with this millstone. In a sense, Babylon is bigger than just a city. It is a system, isn't it? Notice, in a sense, isn't it, that when it talks about Babylon, it talks just about a centrality. The kings of the earth have committed adultery with her. All these merchants who trade with her. This big system that is an enemy of God and her people. But here's a realization, and this is something which needs to wake us up. There's a realization that judgment is final. If you look at this section from 21 to 24, the word "never" is constantly repeated. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpets will never be heard in you again. And this is one variation. No workman or any trade will ever, basically the same thing, just said slightly differently, be found in you again. The sound of millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of the lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of the bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's great men. By your magic spell, all nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and all who have been killed on the earth. And the point is this: God is a God of justice. There is no reprieve. There is no second chance. It will be seen to be right. God will judge, and that will be final. So, you know, there's a real thing, isn't there? There's a real wake-up call to be, as we were saying this morning, as we take us preaching Ecclesiastes with this message. When we were preaching Ecclesiastes 9, and And Solomon says, Solomon was saying, isn't he? As you know, we sometimes talk about people living for the moment in a negative sense. And he said, no, no, live for the moment in a positive sense. You know, acknowledge God. Enjoy it. And as I said, as a church, it's right to have a big vision for the future. It's right to be thinking about all we're doing to, you know, propagate the gospel here in Stony Stratford and beyond. But never forget the work of the gospel at the present time. That goes on. We don't sort of push it to one side because people are out there, people are dying every day and basically going to judgment. And as we saw this morning, you know, it's destined for men to die once. They don't get a second chance. And then face judgment. There's no reprieve. There'll be no ever. There'll never be a second chance. And we see actually in the sense, look at all these things. These things can't bad in themselves. Yeah, maybe they're bad because they're connected with those who persecute Christ. But all the joy, all the good things are taken away forever. So we looked at what Babylon represents, and we see it's terribly bad. We've seen what our reaction should be to Babylon. And lastly, what lesson should we learn? Well, this is really just to sum up, isn't it? Firstly, we've noted, haven't we, the things of the world cannot fulfill us in any way, and they can't save us. We saw that particularly in verse 14. They will say, the fruit you long for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. And 16 and 17, again, they will cry out, woe, woe, that great city, dressed in fine linen, purple, scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Everything's gone. It can't fulfill us. It will be lost eventually. The other thing we have to do is this. We have to learn. Is we need to realise it's possible to share in the sins of such people. Verse 4 was a cry for God's people to be separate. It doesn't mean we can't have Christian and non-Christian friends. Of course not. But it's about setting boundaries in what we do, who we perhaps associate and what entertainment we look at. We are to separate from those who are very much enemies of God's people. The church is to distance itself from the world. Too much time, I think, in certain church circles is very much harking back and saying, why aren't we respected as we used to be? What can we do to gain the popularity of the world again? Well, let's wake up and smell the coffee, folk. One of the things we should learn in Revelation, a very basic fact, is basically the world is an enemy with Christ. An enemy of Christ is at war with Christ. I mean, we saw that, didn't we, back? The pictures that we saw when the beast from the sea and the beast of the earth, and you know how the dragon was aligned with the beast from the sea, and he blasphemed against God, didn't he? Verse 6 of chapter 13. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God, snarled his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and conquer them. Brothers and sisters, let's not get too concerned when we get a bit of flack. If we want to be serious about being in the business of the gospel, we better get used to it. We don't look for it. We don't bait it. But let's get used to the fact that that's where we are. We've seen so clearly recently how much things have shifted around us. Well, lastly, and here's the encouragement, God is a God of justice. We are to rejoice in that. We are to rejoice that one day God will set everything right. And actually, if we're right-thinking people, and we can only be right-thinking people through God saving us, we will rejoice in that. But we will also want, won't we, to see others saved as well. In the end, Revelation is a theme that's coming up. We have to wait a bit for the end of the book because a couple of weeks I'll be away. But it's a tale of two cities. And that's a great picture, isn't it? Because we see this, don't we? There's two sets of people, really, in the world. There's those who love God and there's those who are against God. We may not think they are, but unless they love him and serve him and have their things given, they are living their own lives in opposition to God. And so we see them typified in two cities. And we've seen this one, the one that puts its faith in earthly things, that loves them the things of the world, is basically just a lackey to Satan and his other lackeys. But there's another more glorious one. And we'll have a little preview of where we'll be in a few weeks towards the end of the summer. 21, verse 27. This is the description of the New Jerusalem. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the book of life. In the end, there's only two kinds of people, aren't there? There's those who are in the book of life and there's those who are not. There's only two outcomes. There's the love of God, or there is the judgment of God for rejecting all that is good and proper. There's a judgment of going our own way. Let's be those who want to serve God, who want to be identified for him. And here, I think the chapter like this should really prompt us to this. Seek to serve, and as we're commanded in Scripture, to hold out the words of life to those who are perishing. Let's pray.